Today on Against the Grain. When looking back at pandemics in modern history, the 1918 Spanish influenza stands out. It devastated the countries of the global north, but took its greatest toll in the global south. I'm Sasha Lilly. Science writer Laura Spinney joins me to reflect on the similarities and significant differences between the Spanish flu and COVID-19. She'll discuss how the pandemic took hold at the end of World War I and how many of the affected countries adopted universal healthcare in its wake. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The Spanish influenza killed an unimaginable 50 to 100 million people worldwide, more than all of those who died in World War I, which it partially overlapped and followed. It wiped out young adults, society's breadwinners, while the old did not succumb in such large numbers. For better or worse, the Spanish influenza remains our point of reference for pandemics, and through the history of the 1918 flu outbreak, we can attempt to make sense of the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as flag the substantial differences between the two. To that end, I'm joined from Paris by science journalist Laura Spinney. She's the author of Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World, published by Public Affairs. Laura, looking back, what were the origins of the Spanish influenza? Was it zoonotic, meaning that like the virus that causes COVID-19, it came from animals to humans?
Yes. So it's definitely zoonotic. I mean, flu was initially zoonotic in that at some point in the very dim and distant past, it was only in animals and not in humans. And then at some point it made the leap. Now, of course, flu in general is always in humans. It circulates. We have seasonal flu outbreaks every year. But when we have a flu pandemic, that is a new strain. So it's a new strain of flu that has spilled over from some animal into the human species. And the general consensus is that most flus, not all, but particularly that flu, came from a bird. It can also come from pigs, and in fact, many animal species suffer from flu. But the 1918 pandemic is generally considered to have come directly from a bird.
And in fact, it's part of the same strain, H1N1, that caused the outbreak of swine flu, obviously a different version of it, in 2009. Is that right?
Yeah, and actually that is an interesting historical story because way back as early as the 1930s, if I remember correctly, scientists were suggesting that the strain that caused the 1918 pandemic had passed from humans into pigs. So vets at that time noticed an outbreak of flu in pigs. And of course, the knee-jerk tendency is to say that it came to us from them. But actually, scientists who did some investigation suggested that it was more likely to have been the other way around. Wow. And later studies confirmed that. And so what it looks like what's happened is that the H1N1 that went into pigs then and was evolving in pigs all this time then sort of skipped over into humans again in 2009 and caused a human flu pandemic. So they gave it back to us basically almost a century later.
Fascinating. Well, set the stage for the Spanish influenza. Into what world did it appear?
Well, so it emerged at a time when the world was at war. So the first cases officially reported of the Spanish flu were in the early months of 1918, and the war didn't end until November 1918. So it coincided with that last phase of the war. It was a world, therefore, in upheaval. It was a world where many people in the West, if we can call it that, but not only the West, had embraced germ theory. So the idea that infectious diseases are caused by invisible microscopic organisms, but many had not. And so in many parts of the world, there was a much more mystical, sometimes fatalistic understanding of plagues, to give them their sort of ancient name. I think that is a really interesting thing because it shows up in the way that different populations reacted to the flu and the measures they took to protect themselves against it or to mitigate its effects.
Well, the pandemic came in three waves, in the spring and then again in the fall of 1918, as you say, in the end of World War One, and then again in 1919. Can you tell us how it unfolded and if the bulk of the deaths were in any particular phase?
Okay, so you've given it a nice linear narrative. And one of the problems with the Spanish flu, as with any flu pandemic, is it doesn't really fit a nice linear narrative. Mm-hmm. So for a start, the number of waves and the timings of the waves depended on where you were in the world. And they were staggered in the southern hemisphere with respect to the north. So they came later in the south with respect to the north. That's why we normally say that the pandemic lasted 2 to 3 years. It's quite difficult to measure the end of the pandemic, and we can talk about that later if you like. But 2 to 3 years, because those waves came later in the south. So yes, if you're talking about the northern hemisphere, then we generally speak about three waves, which start with a sort of mild one in the northern hemisphere, spring of 1918, that wasn't that different from seasonal flu and caused the usual sort of havoc, but nothing too dramatic, especially in a world that was at war. So it was kind of the least of their problems. And it went away later that spring, early that summer. And then you got the second wave, which was really the wave. This was the major wave of death. It was so different from that first wave that people called it a different disease. They considered it was not the same disease. Erupted in the sort of tail end of August 1918. The most commonly accepted estimates suggest that 50 to 100 million people died in the world of the Spanish flu. And the vast majority of those deaths took place in the 13 weeks between the middle of September and the middle of December 1918. So this vicious second wave then retreats towards the tail end of the year. And then there's a sort of recrudescence in the early months of 1919, which we kind of refer to as the third wave. And that was intermediate in severity between the other two. There is a school of thought that that wasn't really a separate wave. It was kind of the tail end of the second wave, with interruptions due to end of year holidays, Christmas and Hanukkah and so on, which meant that people's patterns of movement and collecting together changed. And so that changed the pattern of the wave and how it rolled out.
And is it thought now that the virulence of that second wave has to do with the mutation of the flu virus? Or does it also have to do with the social circumstances that people found themselves in? Had they changed, or is a combination of both?
So we know a little bit about this, but there's a lot of unknowns as well. Flu pandemics do seem to have this characteristic pattern that they come in waves, and that there is an initial herald wave. It's particularly cruel if you think about it, because we're kind of lulled into a sense of false security by that first wave, and then it goes away and then the real thing hits. But obviously the virus isn't thinking that way. There is scientific evidence that so the idea now is that a very virulent pandemic strain kind of emerged in the early months of 1918 through a background of the usual seasonal flu. And so it didn't seem so bad. It was kind of pushing through a background of milder flu. And that perhaps at that stage, this new strain had not yet acquired the ability to transmit easily between human beings. Then something happens around the late spring, early summer, and the virus mutates and it becomes highly transmissible amongst human beings. And then that pure pandemic strain comes back with a vengeance in the late summer. That's the idea. And there's good evidence for it in the sense that scientists sequenced the genome of the virus that caused the pandemic strain from 1918. They sequenced it back in 2005. And so, and they have samples from people who died of the spring wave and people who died of the autumn wave, and they can compare those sequences and they can see how they changed.
Those who are most likely to die from COVID-19 are the elderly, but the Spanish influenza mainly affected the young, not the old. Why was that?
So just a preliminary note about COVID-19. I mean, the data is not all in yet. We're still trying to understand how this germ works, new germ works. And up to now, people have been saying that it's the elderly and the people with other conditions who are particularly vulnerable. But I think that's not all who's vulnerable. The people in the intensive care units are also, in some cases, much younger. So we have to be careful about categorizing it so easily, I think. The full picture is not there yet.
Sure.
However, the Spanish flu very clearly differed from seasonal flus in that age profile respect, yes. So most flus are worst in the very young and the very old. So they have a kind of U-shaped mortality curve. And that one had famously a W-shaped mortality curve, which means that there was a middle age group of adults aged between 20 and 40 who were also particularly vulnerable. And in fact, the right-hand stroke of that W was lower than it is usually in a flu season, meaning that elderly people seem to have been slightly more protected in the pandemic than they were in a usual flu season. And there are all sorts of theories about why that is, which we can go into. But to answer your question, yeah, there was a group of adults in the prime of life who were particularly vulnerable. And that's one of the reasons why this pandemic was so devastating to human communities, because it wiped out the productive members of those communities, the breadwinners, the pillars, the fathers, the mothers, and at a time when there was really no safety net to speak of, even in wealthy countries, to catch those who were left behind, the elderly parents and the young children mainly.
As we hear about the Spanish influenza today, we in the United States anyway, usually hear the stories of people in Europe and in the United States, and many people's families were affected by the pandemic. And yet the majority of those who died were actually in what we'd now call the global south. I wonder if you could tell us how those who were colonized did in comparison to the colonizing countries.
So colonization definitely had an impact, but I would sort of say indirectly. I mean, so flu is called the democratic disease because nobody's immune to it. Rich, poor, everyone can catch the flu. But actually, it's not quite accurate. Everyone can catch the flu, but the people who are the most vulnerable to it are the people who are, for example, living in poor substandard accommodation where they're densely packed, and maybe the living arrangements are not well ventilated, or they're overworked, or they're malnourished, or they've got poor access to healthcare, or they have underlying conditions. And those things, unfortunately, align with people who are the poorest in society, or the poorest in the world, in the developing world, or, workers, generally the people at the bottom of the social ladder. So socioeconomic status has a major impact, even today, in disease outbreaks. It undoubtedly will in this COVID-19 pandemic, and it certainly did in 1918. By far the countries that bore the brunt of that pandemic were the poorest, and often by extension, to come back to your question, the colonized. So if I was to give you the example of India, which was a British colony at the time, 18 million Indians died, we estimate, in the Spanish flu, which is the equivalent of the entire death toll of the First World War. And it highlighted, when the pandemic struck India, it highlighted really how pathetic the healthcare provisions were of the colonial authorities for the indigenous population. I mean, they weren't brilliant for the white colonialists either, and a lot of doctors were away at the front, but there was practically nothing for Indians, and that became blatantly clear. And in fact, interestingly, the people who sort of stepped into the breach, because there were no doctors and nurses to look after the people who were suffering in such large numbers, especially in outlying areas, were the people who had already organized themselves to some extent in the fight for independence. So India has a very caste-ridden society, but these were people who had managed to reach out of their own classes and castes to each other in order to fight in the name of independence. And because they'd managed to do that, they also managed to coordinate themselves to help in the public health effort. Now, perhaps what they did didn't make that much difference, because they were no better off than doctors at the time in terms of treating this disease. But it had a major social impact, what they did, and long-term consequences, interestingly, for the fight for independence.
I'm speaking with science journalist, novelist, and author Laura Spinney. She's the author of Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So how did the outbreak of the Spanish influenza in 1918, in the last year of World War I, end up affecting the end of the war and its aftermath?
Well, there's pretty good consensus amongst historians that it accelerated the end of the war, because basically troops on both sides, and the Allied powers and the Axis powers, were losing troops at a terrifying rate to the flu in the trenches in the spring and then again in the autumn waves of the pandemic. It probably accelerated the armistice. There's a more controversial school of thought that it might have influenced who won, because there is some evidence that the Axis powers, so Germany, Austro-Hungary, might have had the flu for longer than the Allied powers further west. And they were also probably overall hungrier, for reasons to do with the Allied blockade of those countries, for example. So that blockade, which stopped supplies coming in, affected both the military and the civilian populations in those countries, and meant that the entire population was probably more vulnerable overall to a new and dangerous respiratory pathogen. Because we know that if you're hungry, your immune system can be compromised. So there is that idea that the flu played into the hands of the Allies, but I would have to say that it would anyway be difficult to prove, and it's a fairly minority view. An interesting one, though, I think.
How about its effects on the social unrest that immediately followed World War I in Europe? Can we see any connection between social unrest and revolution and the Spanish influenza?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, so I mentioned earlier this socioeconomic effect, and people weren't blind to it. They were seeing that, you know, the poorer and the working classes were the ones who were taking the brunt of it. Just to give you a nice little vivid detail, I think, is the fact that in Paris, where I live, one in four women who died of the Spanish flu was a maid. So, and for a long time, just also to speak to that socioeconomic point, epidemiologists were puzzled by their observation that one of the highest death rates in the capital, the French capital, Paris, was in some of the wealthiest districts, until they realized that the people dying there weren't the owners of those addresses. They were the maids and the servants who were living in the chilly chambre de bonne at the tops of the houses. So that socioeconomic effect was very visible. And I think, yeah, fed into many of the, the turbulence was there already. The class tensions were there. There is no doubt about that. This was the time of the Russian revolutions just a few years earlier, and the Russian Civil War. And it was most definitely in the air, even in the United States. There was a Red Scare around 1921. But you have, I think, the Spanish flu feeding into that and exacerbating it in many parts of the world, even in Switzerland, well-organized Switzerland, because in the Swiss military, it was noticed that it was the men in the ranks who were falling sick in droves and not the officers. And, you know, it just kind of fed a general disgruntlement. And Switzerland came very close to revolution in the autumn of 1918, though it managed to avoid it.
You write in your book, Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World, that following the Spanish influenza, in at least some of the affected countries, those countries ended up adopting some form of universal health care. Tell us about that connection, where it took place and how it unfolded.
So I think it's not very widely recognized, perhaps, that the whole idea of eugenics, which was so discredited after the Nazis took it up in the 1930s, was actually quite a mainstream idea in at the time of the First World War and the Spanish flu. So in a lot of countries, there was an idea that if the lower classes caught these infectious diseases and died in large numbers, it was something to do with them, with their sort of lack of fiber and their lack of, you know, just they were just poorer quality human beings who hadn't the drive to succeed in life and to kind of have a better quality of life in general. And everything from immigration policies to public health policies, I mean, one of the reasons the British were so slack in India, and they weren't the only ones, was that they felt it was something, you know, that the native Indians were to some extent responsible for their own misery, and there was nothing you could do about it. And public health meant containing those diseases in the underclasses, not letting them spread to the elites. That was very much the mainstream mentality then. And I think what the pandemic showed in 1918 in no uncertain terms was that you could not blame an individual for catching a disease or treat them, him or her, in isolation. It was a social problem and it had to be treated at the level of a society, at the level of a population. And so although the idea of kind of socialized medicine, universal healthcare that's available to everybody had been floated, you know, from the late 19th century, particularly in Germany. Germany was a pioneer in this. Nothing had really come of it so far. And that's not surprising, given that it takes time and a great deal of effort to put such a system in place. I mean, first of all, you have to work out how you're going to pay for it. The Germans had a sort of national insurance scheme from the late 19th century, which pretty much lives on today in the method that it uses to pay for healthcare. So you have to do that first, and then you have to reorganize the way you distribute healthcare, because in the 19th century, doctors were generally either self-employed or employed by charities or religious institutions. They were not organized in a sort of nationwide system with community, district, provincial levels as they are very much more today. So it's a massive task to put in a system. And what I argue in my book is simply that the pandemic gave it a huge stimulus, because it was realized that you had to tackle this as soon as it happened, and you had to tackle it across the board. So I think every nation, big nation anyway, that was capable of doing such a thing realized that. And you see, starting in the 1920s, the kind of consolidation and reorganization of healthcare systems everywhere. But different countries took different approaches to particularly the way they paid for it. So in Europe, many nations following the Russian model sort of went the way of national insurance schemes, and you pay for it indirectly through your taxes, but the care is free at the point of delivery. Whereas in the States, a different model was pursued. It has to be said, partly because of fear of communism and too much state intervention, where it would be paid for instead by employer-based insurance schemes. And those kind of proliferated through the 1930s. But in a way, at the time, even though they were paying for it by different methods, the underlying concept was the same, which was to expand access to healthcare and make it far more organized in a nationwide sense and accessible to all, or to as many as possible.
Well, of course, when we think of pandemics, we think of the enormous blow to society of so many people killed. But of course, the Spanish influenza also left its mark on people who didn't die, who survived, who had it and survived, but whose health was permanently affected by it. Can you talk about that? Because any new system of healthcare would have to also take into account that you had this large swath of the population, including people of, you know, who are young and breadwinners, affected by the influenza.
Yeah, so I mean, we are talking about flu, so it's a different disease from COVID-19, and we don't know what the after effects, if any, will be of COVID-19 yet. But there does seem to be some evidence that in the wake of so the flu recedes around 1920, 21, depending on where you were in the world. But then there's a kind of wave of, I suppose we might call it post-viral fatigue. You know, it had been a very vicious flu, and the people who recovered from it went through very often, at least according to anecdotal and medical reports, a kind of phase of fatigue and lassitude and even depression. And in some parts of the world, there's even evidence that that affected the economy, that, you know, so many people were kind of knocked out for a time that the economy actually suffered again. So there was that. It's quite difficult to get at historically, but there is the odd study. There's work from Norway, for example, which suggests that there were many more admissions to psychiatric institutions following the pandemic than there had been following previous flu outbreaks, that builds a fairly good case for linking that to earlier infection with the flu. But it's all a bit tenuous. Something happened there, certainly. We just don't really know the scale of it. There was also the strange phenomenon of encephalitis lethargica, which was a wave of Parkinsonian-like disease that swept over the world in the years after the pandemic, and that left, some people paralyzed and in a kind of locked-in type of state. It's the story of that population is the story that Oliver Sacks told in Awakenings, his best-selling book that was turned into a film. And it was a horrible fate for those people. We don't know. There's never been any definitive evidence that was directly linked to the flu, that being infected with the Spanish flu brought on that condition. There have been strong suspicions and there's strong circumstantial evidence, but the sort of killer proof, which would be, you know, you'd need to find something like viral RNA from the 1918 flu in the brain tissue of people who had died of that Parkinsonian-like, they called it sleepy sickness, because it seemed to come on with a sort of sleepiness. You'd have to find something like that in order to draw a direct link. It hasn't been found yet. That doesn't mean it's not there in, you know, tissue samples from those people who've now more passed away. But perhaps our techniques aren't sensitive enough to detect it yet. So it's a story for which the jury is still out. I was also thinking about the people who were in the womb at the time that the Spanish flu struck, because that's another long-term consequence, if you like, of the pandemic. So pregnant women suffered miscarriages and actually died at alarmingly high rates during the pandemic. So a lot of that generation that was in the womb was just completely annihilated. But some of those babies survived to be born. And in fact, it was a very unlucky generation, because they grew up and came of age, at least the men, just in time to sign up for the Second World War. But there's also some evidence that they were a diminished generation, both in physical and in cognitive terms, because of the sort of physiological stresses that they experienced while in the womb, even though they survived. So They did less well at school. They were more likely to go to prison, more likely to die of heart disease, for example, at an earlier age. They were slightly smaller overall. They had all these disadvantages, which is one reason why in my book I describe them as the real lost generation. So often, at least in where I come from, the lost generation tends to refer to those sort of relatively well-born young men who the First World War never came back and never fulfilled what might have been promising destinies. Mm-hmm. But they were vastly outnumbered by those who were either never born or born with that unfortunate handicap of having survived the Spanish flu in the womb that was that generation.
Science journalist Laura Spinney is my guest. After this music break, we'll return with her. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today I'm speaking with Laura Spinney about her book, Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World, and that's published by Public Affairs. She is a science journalist, novelist, and author, and I'm Sasha Lilly. You mentioned that the Spanish influenza receded around 1920-21. How did it recede?
Gradually, and basically there were further outbreaks of milder disease, because what happens is that so every strain of seasonal flu that is now circulating in the world started as a pandemic strain. It started as a new strain in human beings that was very virulent because it hadn't yet encountered us as a host, and then because it's in the flu's, so to speak, evolutionary interest to moderate its virulence over time, because it wants to keep us alive, us, its host, in order to spread it far and wide, it gradually evolves over time to become more milder, less virulent, and so we kind of live with it in a more of a harmonious equilibrium with these occasional outbreaks of seasonal flu. So that's what you see. That's why a pandemic never really ends. It just recedes gradually as the virus mutates, evolves, and becomes less virulent. And that's why the shape of a pandemic or an epidemic is the kind of bell curve. So you see the pandemic coming on gradually. It doesn't have a kind of concrete start either. It comes on as it emerges in the world and becomes transmissible between human beings. It peaks, it kind of increases exponentially to start with, because as it emerges, it encounters this completely immunologically naive population, which is us, and it's surrounded by susceptible hosts. So it grows very quickly to begin with. And then either as people die or as they gain immunity because they recover, the pool of susceptible hosts shrinks. And so you see the pandemic peaking, leveling off, receding. And then at the same time, you've got the virus begins to mutate and become more benign. And so it's still there circulating for a long time after, but it's getting gradually milder.
Well, obviously, we really don't have that much data on COVID-19. Much information is flowing in, but of course, it's all highly dynamic. And much of information about general populations is very spotty because of who is being tested and who's not being tested. But what can you say about what we know now about the fatality rate of the Spanish influenza? And at this point, can anything be said in terms of comparing the two?
Well, it's very difficult because on both ends of this comparison, you have a moving target. So the figure that is generally given for Spanish flu case fatality rate, i.e., the proportion of people who fall sick with it who go on to die, is around 2%, 2.5%. But that's incredibly hazy because, as I think I mentioned earlier, there was no reliable diagnostic test at the time. So we really don't know the exact numbers of who got sick. It's always easier to calculate the number of dead because it's hard to ignore them. But who is sick, who is staying at home and not declaring their sickness, perhaps because it's mild, or who is not suffering from flu but some other respiratory infection is much harder to get at. And retrospectively, obviously, it makes it even harder. So that end of the comparison, the 1918 end, is a moving target. And it's often pointed out to me, why do you say that the CFR, case fatality rate for 1918, why do you repeat this figure of 2.5% when we now work with 50 million at least dead and over an estimated 500 million cases in the world, which would give you a CFR of 10%. And if it's 100 million dead, that's 20%. I mean, I think both those numbers are possible, but the higher up you go towards global estimates rather than kind of city or country estimates, the vaguer you get and the harder it is to rely on those figures because they were for one reason alone, and there are many others, which is that they were counted differently in different countries. So obviously, it's useful to pool those numbers in order to get a sense of the global impact of that pandemic. But when you want to calculate things like lethality, it's very difficult to use those figures. So that's why it's hard to say whether it was 2.5%, 10%, 20%. But 2.5%, there's good reasons for working with that figure again, with all the caveats that it's uncertain, because it's drawn from places where the data was relatively well collected. So let's say it's 2.5%. Now, moving on to COVID-19, on the original Chinese data, I think it was last week, the WHO announced a provisional CFR of 3.4%. Now, obviously, that is alarmingly high if it's true. But we can't rely on that either because many mild cases again may have gone unreported. There may have been, for example, a situation where the hospitals in Wuhan were just overrun and could only take the most severe cases, so they weren't seeing the less bad ones. So it's not to be taken as a final figure by any means. The number of experts that I've spoken to, epidemiologists, experts in infectious diseases, and so on, they say that they believe it will settle somewhere around 1 to 2%, which is still very high. The 0.1, the CFR that is given as typical of flu pandemics is around 0.1%. So 1 to 2% is high, and it means that this is serious stuff. We need to take it seriously. At the same time, people have to understand what hides behind these numbers. So again, all these figures are very provisional, but it looks as if in around 80% of cases, the disease is mild and most people should be able to take care of it at home. But that is an evolving picture and it's still enormous. If the entire world's population is infected, it's still enormous numbers of sick people if you're talking about 15% with severe disease and 5% with critical disease, that is, people who may need intensive care unit care. So it's partly to do with the scale of it, the fact that it's global. And then, small percentages of very ill people become very large numbers quite quickly.
Well, let's talk more about some of the differences between influenza and the coronavirus and the Spanish influenza and what we're experiencing now. Flus tend to spread evenly through populations, while coronaviruses tend to infect people in clusters. So, unlike the flu, if action's taken against coronaviruses to contain them, in theory, they should be more containable than the flu. Is
Yeah,
that?
and in fact, one of the messages that the experts have been trying to put out these last couple of weeks is don't make that comparison to the flu because it's not helpful. Flu is something we do think about as uncontainable. Once it's out, we can't get it back in. You know, we just have to live through it. And that's not a helpful mindset when you have a disease which is potentially as lethal as this one, with all the caveats that I just mentioned, but spreads differently. We can get around it, and we should, to the extent that we possibly can. We can still rein it in. We may not be able to contain it entirely, but we can still delay it. And that involves many of the same techniques, because we haven't got a vaccine, probably won't have one for a year at the earliest. 18 months is more likely, and even that is a stretch. So we really do need to delay the peak of this pandemic. We need to put it off, because we need to spare our health systems as long as possible. We need to protect our elderly people. We need to make sure that the health systems can cope. It doesn't all land at the same time, that it's spread out, that we have the capacity, basically. And there's another hope, which is that obviously we don't know this yet because we've only just become familiar with this pathogen this winter. But it's possible that, like flu, it doesn't like warm weather. And that if we can delay the peak of the pandemic until later in the spring or the summer, then it might recede, or at least it might not hit, that peak might not hit our health systems, while in the Northern Hemisphere, at least, they're still struggling with all the other respiratory infections that come with winter, and they're putting pressure on our intensive care units.
Right, but that, of course, remains to be seen, the seasonality or lack thereof. Well, Donald Trump is kind of counting on it, and the World Health Organization has said we just don't know at this point. What lessons, though, bearing in mind what you've said, that we should be a bit careful about comparing coronaviruses with influenzas because they don't operate in the same way, but what lessons can be learned from the experience of the Spanish influenza? I wanted to ask you about the public health measures that were put in place at that time. Are there things that we can learn today about how states should or should not come at a pandemic in terms of dealing with the public?
We're in a really interesting period now because we're in this period where we have no vaccine. And so our best hopes are what are collectively known as social distancing measures. That's things like quarantine, isolation, masks, hand washing, you know, self-isolation, all these things, which essentially work by keeping the sick and the healthy apart, and so slowing the spread of the disease. Those do not change really very much over time. They're the same techniques that were being used in 1918. So I think that when you talk about social distancing, then, you know, the historical parallels do become valid.
And then what about things like closing down borders, mandatory public health measures? What can be learned from the experience of the past here?
Closing down borders doesn't work. We know that. I think we're seeing right now that it can be counterproductive because countries can invest their efforts into that, perhaps think they've solved the problem, and then they find the germ is on the inside. They haven't been testing for it rigorously enough. They haven't done the contact tracing, and now it's all over and they have a problem in their hospitals. So I think that's the way that can be counterproductive. That's not to say that even at that point, even where we are now, social distancing methods are still very important because for all the reasons I explained earlier, for delaying the peak of the epidemic. And I think another lesson we've learned from 1918 on is that imposing health measures doesn't work, at least not in our relatively free societies. It worked in China. They pulled it off. But I'd have to say, from what I've been reading, it was a fairly close run thing. I mean, imagine if you had 60 million people under lockdown and you had a rebellion. That would be quite hard to contain. There were riots in the SARS outbreak in China 18 years ago when the government was very, very less transparent with information than it was this time. And even this time, though people broadly complied, there was a lot of frustration expressed on social media in China, especially after the death of the so-called whistleblower doctor. There was huge outrage expressed. So I think it was a gamble even on the part of the Chinese government. our governments and governments in general and the WHO know that it's far better if people comply voluntarily with public health measures. But for that to happen, they need to be well informed. They need to understand the level of the threat they're facing. And they have to trust the authorities to be telling them to do the right thing. They have to trust them to be acting in their collective interest. Trust in authority is not something we're massively strong on these days.
Indeed not. I'm speaking with science journalist Laura Spinney. She is the author of Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, in a world where people don't trust authorities and where often in a crisis like this, states have not done a particularly good job handling it in its initial weeks, there can be all sorts of theories that float around about the origin of the pandemic or strange ideas about how to treat it. I wonder if you could comment on parallels you see between now and 1918 with the Spanish influenza about conspiracy theories and pandemics.
Yeah, I mean, this I think is really interesting. And I think it was worse in 1918 because of this sort of slightly looser grip on germ theory and the idea that infectious diseases are caused by microbes. Then it was much easier to believe in. And also you have to remember that then people were weary. They were psychologically tired after 4 years of war. And it was easier to kind of think of these apocalyptic explanations. People were much more likely to link it to the war. There was a theory, for example, that it was to do with noxious gases rising off the battlefields of Flanders from all the dead bodies, and these gases were wafting over the world and making everybody sick. There were all sorts of rumors, you know, divine punishment for the war often. There was a rumor that was in the US newspapers that did the rounds that unfortunately the newspapers picked up on and circulated, but I think it was initially stated by someone quite high up in the medical administration, so that's probably why they picked up on it, that German U-boats had beached on the coast of America and unleashed this germ in a kind of bioterrorist attack. And, you know, those sorts of rumors have not been completely absent this time, that this was a kind of Chinese bioterrorism deliberately unleashed. You see that kind of thing, and I think it speaks to our very primitive fears of these epidemics and our sort of knee-jerk reaction of blaming the other, which also, of course, feeds into the whole closing the borders thing and the whole stigmatizing the other. And also that fear affects how people try to protect themselves from the disease or cure themselves if they've already caught it. And of course, this is where the fake news comes in. There have been some awful reports that I've read in the last few days about people thinking they can protect themselves by taking cocaine, although that might be wishful thinking, who knows, or by drinking. There was a story of 27 Iranians who died after drinking methanol, industrial alcohol, because they thought it could protect them. So just horrifying things. And an indication, I think, of the fact that it's, you know, how important it is that people are given clear messaging from the top down, but they also know who to listen to, what sources to trust, and are reassured that, you know, that there are treatments out there and they don't need to resort to these crazy ones.
Epidemiologists and other public health experts have been warning for years of possible pandemics, including influenza. What sort of measures do you think should have been put in place to be ready for a pandemic like this, since a lot of people saw some version of this coming?
I think that disease outbreaks, even zoonotic outbreaks, the spillover of pathogens, new pathogens from animals to us, is probably something that we can't stop altogether. What we can do is stop those events turning into global health crises of the kinds we're confronting right now. And in order to do that, we need to have better surveillance at that animal-human interface. we need to invest in more robust health infrastructure all over the world, because as we're seeing yet again, we're only as safe as our least safe place. So we need to invest in health infrastructure in the poorest countries as well as the richest. We are doing better. We do learn from each, you know, each catastrophe, I think, each disaster. There was a new ranking that was released last October by Johns Hopkins, I think, and various other organizations whose names I've forgotten, called the Global Health Security Index. And that's very interesting because it ranks countries on their pandemic preparedness along various different dimensions. And so now we can see where each country's weakness is when it comes to preparing for pandemics. No country is perfect, but for example, China is, which is very strong on many things, detecting and responding to new pandemic threats, for example, it is not strong on prevention, and particularly in the food security area. So clearly now China needs to invest more in that. It perhaps didn't act fast enough after the SARS outbreak to regulate the so-called wet markets, the live markets in animals, from where this new pathogen seems to have sprung. But these are things that take time to do. So after SARS, the Chinese government banned live markets and it didn't work. They just went underground and became black markets. And it's a very big part of Chinese culture. And in some parts of China, up to 60, people rely on those markets for up to 60% of their food. So it's not something that can be banished in one fell swoop. It's something that needs to be regulated in an evidence-based way and subjected to much more rigorous surveillance. And if that's one lesson we take away from this pandemic, then that would be very good.
Laura Spinney, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure.
Laura Spinney is the author of Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World. That's published by Public Affairs, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's a science journalist, novelist, and author. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.